the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Donald Trump promises to drive huge growth in the United States, but is our endless pursuit of economic growth a good thing? Has Northern Hemisphere prosperity come with too high a price tag? Is there a better way to measure our success? These are the questions asked by our next guest in his new book, Growth: A Reckoning, which has been shortlisted for the Financial Times and Schroeder Business Book of the Year 2024. Daniel Susskind is a research professor in economics at King's College London and a senior research associate at the Institute for Ethics and EI, Ethics in EI at Oxford University, and he joins me now. Daniel Susskind, you're very welcome to the programme. You say in the book that for thousands of years we had no growth at all economically. People's lives were stagnant in a way. What do you mean by that?
That's right. I mean, it wasn't even thousands of years. It was hundreds of thousands of years. For most of human history, economic life was stagnant. You know, whether you were a hunter-gatherer in the Stone Age or someone labouring away at the start of the Industrial Revolution, although your lives would have differed in lots of respects, you know, what clothes you wore, what you did for fun and so on, fundamentally from an economic point of view, your lives would have been remarkably similar. You would have been stuck in a relentless struggle for subsistence. Economic growth that we think of today, it's an incredibly recent phenomenon. If we think of human history as being an hour long, all 300,000 years of it, economic growth sort of occurred in the last half second or so.
One of the things that you want to tackle in the book is not only growth, but sort of obsession with growth and the idea of measuring growth with GDP. And you say in the book that this is actually a relatively new concept. When did GDP emerge?
It's incredibly new. And this is what I think is quite surprising, that, you know, today GDP, gross domestic product, sits at the center of our common life together. You know, the fate of politicians sort of rises and falls depending on whether or not that number, GDP, rises and falls. And what's so interesting is that essentially before the 1950s, almost no politicians, policymakers, economists, anyone is talking about the idea of economic growth. And the really, I think, fascinating thing is that even if people had decided they wanted to pursue economic growth, before the 1950s, it just wouldn't have been possible. The GDP measure is only really created in the early 1940s. Before then, policymakers, politicians don't really have a reliable sense of how big the economy is and whether it's growing, and if so, by how much.
So it might be useful to have GDP as an economic measurement of growth, but it's when it becomes sort of almost an end goal in itself that the problem arises. And you talk about the growth dilemma. What do you mean by that?
On the one hand, growth is associated with almost every measure of human flourishing. But on the other hand, growth is also associated with many of the great challenges that we face today as well. And the argument I make in the book is that it's not simply associated with the challenge of climate change, but it's also associated, or ought to be associated, with growing inequalities in society, with the development of technologies like AI, whose disruptive effects on work and politics it's not clear we can control, and a whole variety of other prices. And so at the center of political life today is what I call, exactly as you say, this growth dilemma, this feeling of wanting, of desperately wanting more growth, but at the same time feeling like we also want less of it as well, that feeling of being wrenched in two very different directions.
When it comes to the economy, one school of thought says, okay, this growth dilemma that's there, the solution is to slow things down. What does deliberately slowing down an economy, presumably on the part of the government or politicians, what does that actually look like and what does it achieve?
That's right. There's an increasingly popular movement, the degrowth movement, that says exactly that, that what we ought to do, if growth is the problem, we ought to press pause or even sometimes go into reverse. And it's an increasingly popular idea. Politicians like Caroline Lucas, activists like Greta Thunberg, environmentalists like David Attenborough all appeal to this idea in different ways. I think they get something right, which is that something has to give. We cannot keep on going in the way that we have been going, neglecting the tremendous price of growth, not simply the environmental price, but all the other different dimensions as well. But, in my view, it really would be one of the greatest acts of self-harm that humankind could inflict upon itself if it were to decide to really press pause on growth or go into a reverse. It doesn't seem to me to be a sensible idea. Just to give you one example, just to sort of make it more concrete, if we interpret degrowth as meaning freezing global GDP per head at its current level, well, that's going to mean either condemning 700, 800 million people to extreme poverty, which is what that would require, or if you find that uncomfortable, you're going to have to find a way of slashing the incomes of the 7.1 billion people that remain, practically all of the Western population. It's just, for me, both a sort of economic and a political non-starter.
So even if you disagree with some of the ideas or the thinking that someone like David Attenborough or Greta Thunberg would say about how to do this and to have degrowth, even if you disagree with some of the findings, the reality, the fundamental point they're making is still true, that you cannot have infinite growth with finite resources. And the way that resources are being utilized right now, a disproportionately small number of wealthy individuals in the world are using up a disproportionately high number of the limited resources that are available.
I think this idea, and it's become a sort of slogan for the degrowth movement, that you cannot have infinite growth on a finite planet. I think that's fundamentally wrong, though. I think that view of the world is wrong. In fact, you can have infinite growth on a finite planet.
How, though?
Yeah, exactly. And the reason I think it's wrong is because it's based on a misunderstanding about how growth actually works. It's a view that growth comes from using more and more physical material resources, plowing more land, using more people, using more raw materials and so on. But that isn't where economic growth comes from. Growth doesn't come from using more and more finite resources, but growth comes from discovering ever more productive ways of using those resources. In other words, economic growth comes from technological progress. Growth doesn't come from this tangible world of finite resources. It comes from the intangible world of ideas.
But the technology needs equipment, and there is only a finite amount of resources to construct and make that equipment. You still come back to the limitations
and
of the planet.
And so the big challenge for us is, how do we use those resources ever more productively and ever more efficiently? So let me give you an example of a transformation that I think is particularly revealing. If you were to go back to 2007 and have a look at the Stern Review into the economics of climate change, which was the sort of first report of its kind, one of the central conclusions of that report was that if we wanted to reduce emissions by 80%, it would cost us 1% of GDP per year. In other words, there was a big trade-off between growth and the climate. If we wanted to protect the climate, we'd have to pay a price in terms of growth. The next year, Nicholas Stern, the report's author, comes forward and says, no, I got it wrong. Actually, climate change is worse than I thought. It's going to cost us 2% of GDP per year to reduce emissions by 80%. Fast forward, though, to the year 2020, and the UK Climate Change Committee, which is the group of experts tasked with advising the British government on climate issues, one of the central conclusions of their work was that to completely eliminate emissions, so not simply reduce them, but to eliminate them, would cost us just 0.5% of GDP per year. In other words, the trade-off between growth and the climate had dramatically improved. We had to pay a far smaller price in terms of growth to protect the climate.
But what about using technology and the likes of AI, which everybody says will improve productivity? But we can't eat AI. We still have a limited amount of resources to be able to feed a growing population on the planet.
Sure. So that's absolutely right. But there's a really important insight in that environmental story, which is more and more countries around the world are able to grow while reducing their emissions in absolute terms. And that is something that was inconceivable 30 years ago. What's driving a lot of it is the extraordinary progress in renewable energy that's taken place, particularly solar panels. The reason why is that there was an exponential decline in the cost of solar energy from about $100 per watt back in, you know, a few decades ago to about half a dollar per watt today. When we talk about growth, we tend to think the sort of metaphor we have in mind is that the economy is like a train and we're the train drivers, and you can kind of push down on the throttle and go faster and get more growth, or you can pull back and get less growth. But essentially, that's the only choice that you have. Do you want more growth or do you want less growth? And I say, no, that's wrong. A far better metaphor is a nautical one. We can raise the sail and go faster, pull it down and go slower. But there's also a huge variety of different directions we can take, different types of economic growth we can pursue.
And where does that start? Does that start with business people? Does it start with politicians? Does it start with consumers?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if you look again at the environmental setting, it's been a combination of three different things. It's been really significant changes in taxes and subsidies, and that's sort of state-driven. It's been changes in rules and regulations, and again, sort of state-driven. But really important as well have been changes in social norms and customs with respect to the environment. And it's those combination of things that have just completely transformed the incentives in society, so that, you know, people are encouraged now, entrepreneurs and technologists, to develop technologies that just, you know, aren't simply more capable, but they're also green. And that's the spirit of what I think we ought to be doing more generally for thinking about the trade-off between growth and all these other things that we might value and care about.
Okay, well, it's a fascinating read. Daniel Susskind, research professor in economics at King's College London and a senior research associate at the Institute for Ethics in AI at Oxford University. The book is called Growth: A Reckoning. Thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.